my opinion somewhat, but still, I am not convinced that on one hand, all the databases need to be closed, or on the other hand, all the databases need to be open to the world. I mean, there are legitimate reasons for access, and we're going to be talking about that. So, as I say in all the talks I give, I'm not going to tell you what to think, but I am going to try to tell you what to think about. Database collection has been around forever. Since the days of the Bible, people have been counted, people have been pigeonholed, people have been categorized. Here's what's different in the past 10 years. First of all, computing power and speed. I have now in my office more data and more data storage space than the FBI computers had 10 years ago. Storage space, you can go now to a store and get a 750 gig drive for, what, about $300. You can set up an array of computers that will process whatever data you gather so quickly that 10 years ago you would have had to use literally a Cray supercomputer to do the equivalent amount of computing. Everything is now in digital format. Everything you do, when you fill out an application, when you buy an item, when you make a telephone call, when you go through an Easy Pass lane or use a Metro card, everything is already in digital format, which means taking it, putting it in a database, analyzing it and indexing it, never has to be touched by human hands. You today, not some third party typing in front of a terminal, you are contributing all the data about you. OCR, optical character recognition. Even the old data, the stuff that's on paper forms 20 years ago, 30 years ago, is being OCR'd at the speed of light, and it's being sucked into databases. And why? Because data is worth money. You access a database, you typically pay a substantial flat rate to access that database, can be thousands of dollars a month, or you pay per search. And the more hits the user gets, the more money the database provider gets, and the happier they are. So they're going to keep sucking in info, so you'll pay for access to it. People are also willingly, and we're going to talk about this in great detail tonight, people are also willingly contributing enormous amounts of personal data about themselves. And when I say personal, I don't mean their address and phone number. I mean ridiculously personal things. You go to MySpace pages, people talk about drug use, sexual activity, religion, you know, sexual orientation, politics, things they won't tell their own family. Anybody who accesses their MySpace page is going to be able to determine immediately. And by the way, all of that data, there are bots right now, my bots, other people's bots, running through MySpace, running through Friendster, running through Bebo and everything else, sucking down that information and categorizing it.
Okay. So that was Stephen Rambam when we figured it out. It's from 2006, 10 years ago. As you can see, there are some things that are dated, but the dated things are the names of the products like MySpace and Friendster and things like that, not the ideas behind it. So that was excerpt here on WBAI New York, where it's 8 o'clock. And we are extending an hour. If you're tuning in for the Personal Computer Show, you'll be very disappointed because they are not on tonight. I think they're on next week, so hopefully you'll tune in then. They might even be on for longer next week to make up for this. I'm happy to say Steve Rambam is joining us live. Welcome, Steve. I hope your travel wasn't too painful.
No, I managed to find a cab.
Good, good.
And now I'm here to tell all the personal computer aficionados why their machine is plotting to kill them.
Yeah, well, people need to hear that. You know, so it's important. But we were also having a discussion off mic about transit, because we were talking about transit earlier in the show, and you had a very interesting statement about surveillance and transit here in New York City.
I don't know why you would find it surprising. What I said was that any way that you try to get from point A to point B in the city of New York, you are going to be surveilled. Mm-hmm. You are going to be observed. And they, and I hate to use the word they because it makes me sound like a black helicopter guy. So by they, let me be very, very specific. The city of New York and the NYPD will know that Emmanuel is going from point A to point B, either in his vehicle, because the ALPR is going to pick it up, automatic license plate readers, which are now everywhere,
yeah,
and on the
everywhere.
Back of many of the police cars, hundreds of the police cars. Mm-hmm. For people who don't know what I'm talking about, if you see a police car with those two weird forward-facing cameras on the rear trunk, those are ALPR cameras, automatic license plate readers. They can do 60,000 license plates per hour, each one of those cars, or each one of the cameras. And there are choke points. If you go to the busier train stations now, you will see Speco cameras with wireless transmission back to the mothership. You'll see a box that says NYPD on it with two globes below it, which are 360-degree 24-hour day-night cameras that are broadcasting to the NYPD Command Center. I forget what the heck it's called. I used to know that. There's some obnoxious name for it. If you're going by foot, either those cameras are going to pick you up, or there's now a public-private partnership where just last year the NYPD added 4,000 cameras that were linked to them by private industry. If you use, obviously, EasyPass, not only is EasyPass recorded at the choke points, and NYPD is brilliant for setting up choke points, positions where you, locations where you must go through if you want to get from point A to point B, not only will your EasyPass be recorded at the choke points, but in Manhattan, there's EasyPass readers in locations in Manhattan that's recording EasyPass cars, EasyPass-equipped cars driving past them. MetroCard, if you use a MetroCard, obviously MetroCard is grabbed at the point you use it also. And if you've paid for it with a credit card, or if somehow that MetroCard has been linked to you, like when you've been stopped and frisked and refrisked and restopped, which, by the way, I'm not opposed to. I'm opposed to some of the things that happen during the stop and frisk. But I think everybody should be frisked at least once a day. You know, at least once a day.
Wow.
Me, I'll volunteer for two or three times.
Consider it kind of a hug, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. It is an urban hug. Absolutely.
Wow. Well, I'm sure that'll provoke some discussion, but it makes you think, though, about how much you are being watched. I mean, we used to think it was just London that did this, but now it's everywhere.
Well, London is the... When it comes to deployment of technologies, England is the best. When it comes to development of technologies, Israel is the best. But America is very smart. America sits back. America behaves like every good technology user. It never buys version 1.0. It always waits till the bugs are taken out. And the surveillance technologies that you see being deployed, especially in New York, but everywhere in America and by America, are very robust, very perfected technologies. By the time they're invading your privacy with them, they work great. They work great. They let them be developed in country A, tested in country B. DNA is from the United Kingdom before here. Camera surveillance technologies are from the United Kingdom before here. Many, many of the key critical technologies were beta tested, so to speak, in the UK. And then we brought them here once they were working great.
So what is your advice to people who are concerned about their privacy? Is it just to accept
privacy
this?
Is dead? Get over it.
So that's really your message.
But that really is my message. But more than that, look, I have a lot of messages connected to privacy. But first of all, it's not even privacy anymore. Privacy was 1.0. 2.0 was anonymity. You might not have been able to be private, but you could go and put yourself in a little cyber bubble or personal bubble and be anonymous. You can't do that anymore. Anonymity is dead. Get over it. Now we're moving to 3.0, and this is one of the things that I'm going to be talking about at the HOPE conference. We are at the point where the technologies and the equipment and the software and the bots, and I'm going to sound like a nut here, but I'll detail it as I always do at the conference. So please withhold your opinion, listeners, until you hear the full presentation at HOPE. Now we're talking about the machines messing with your mind. 3 weeks ago, there was an internal conference at Facebook, and the question was put to the weasel in chief, Zuckerberg, should we do something to keep Trump from being elected president? That was actually a topic, and I've got the notes and the screenshot and everything, which, of course, I'll be putting up for everybody at home.
How did you get that?
I'm a sneaky guy. but it's legit. I really vouch for it.
Okay,
I really
all right.
vouch for it. Nobody who saw that, and believe me, I'm not the only person who saw that. By the time it got to me, it's been through about 100 hands, and I'm sure if you Google it, it's got to be somewhere on the net by now. If I have it, you know, CNET has to have it, or as I call it, Ars Technica, or whoever.
A search is underway.
Yes. What nobody has stopped to think is, hey, wait a second. If they ask that question, it means they can do that. The truth is, you now have entire ecosystems. You have a Google ecosystem. You have a Facebook ecosystem. You have a ferocious Apple ecosystem. They even restrict where you can pair your phone. They control what you see and how things are fed to you. You get news that Facebook thinks you should see. You get messages that Facebook thinks you can see. There are hidden message boxes on Facebook that you have hundreds of messages in that you've never seen. And by the way, thank God for that, because Facebook actually is really, really good at putting the crappy, annoying messages in the box you never check. But that's not a good excuse. You know, it's like the Librarians Association said about Google, when Google was grabbing all the books and scanning them, you know, irrespective of copyright. They said it's like saying it's okay for you to break into my house because you're going to clean my kitchen. I mean, little benefit for a big insult. You know, right now, your entire life is being manipulated in many ways. You are being pushed certain information that you have not independently curated. People have curated that for you. You are being pushed to reveal more and more information. Hey, you haven't posted a picture for a month. Don't you want to share something with your friends? No, I really don't. And frankly, they'll stay my friends if I don't. You know, I'm being a little flip, as I always am when I go on your show, because I'm among friends and I'm having a good time. But this is a terrifically serious issue.
Yes.
Destruction of privacy was a big deal. Destruction of anonymity was an exponentially bigger deal. You know, if I want to express a political opinion, if I want to own a firearm, if I want to support a certain candidate, if I want to be a friend to a disliked country, and so on and so on, I want to be able to do it anonymously. You can't do that anymore. Your ability to not reveal your politics and your habits and your hobbies are gone. So anonymity is now gone. Now we're talking about the ability to obtain sufficient information and the proper information and complete information, comprehensive information, to make an informed decision. And I got to tell you, this is the biggest deal, because the promise of the internet, the promise of this wire jacked into your computer coming into your house was, holy cow, I have access to the world's information. I can look at what I need to look at, I can access what I need to access, and I can make an informed decision, and I can make up my own mind. You know, truth is going to win, because the real information, all sides of an argument, are going to be available, and I can make up my own mind. I'm not an idiot, I can make up my own mind. And that promise is now being shredded, because Facebook is showing you what they want. Google News is showing you what they want. Apple is controlling the device that today you do most of your internet access on. Most people don't go to a terminal anymore and whip out the keypad. Most internet browsing and news access and social networking and all of that is now done on a smartphone.
Most interaction, period, seems to be done on a smartphone.
Well, not for me and old guys like me, but for the cool kids like you, yes.
Oh, no, don't say that, because...
I know, you have a flip phone.
No, well, I had a flip phone. It flipped into pieces, but...
What do you have now?
I have a smartphone, but I barely use
one?
It. I'm not going to say on the radio what kind of phone I have, or I won't have a phone by the end of the show.
how hard do you think it is to find out?
It's probably not that hard.
I mean, you send an email to somebody. Look in the email. It shows what device.
Yeah, but I don't send emails from my phone. That's one thing. I just my phone is for talking and for maybe sending a text message every now and then. It's not for staring at when I'm hanging out with other people.
Do you realize what a ridiculous anachronism you are?
I know. Well, I am told too, that by many the way. Times.
I am also. But I'm buying a new iPhone. I'm going to the dark side. I'm buying a new iPhone because, frankly, some of the apps, which, by the way, let me just put it out there, 45% of all apps leech personal information.
Yes.
But you know what? Let them leech it. I'm enjoying some of these apps.
I can imagine you are. But my question, though, is for those people listening who are currently unplugging their computers, if you simply disconnect from the internet, are you safe then?
First of all, you can't just unplug your computer. You have to unplug your thermostat. You have to unplug your refrigerator. You have to unplug your oven. You have to unplug your smoke detector.
So the smart home is the danger.
And like my friend's joke is, the Internet of Things is trying to kill me. The Internet of Things is invading your privacy in ways that, look, there's a diaper that tweets when your baby's wet.
Oh, come on. Is this true?
Yeah, it really is. Huggies. There's a diaper that, I mean, honestly, you have to be the world's most miserable parent to need to be, to have your baby's ass tweet you. But here's the best one.
Well, it's not the ass. Here's the best one. Technically, it's the diaper,
but I didn't, you know, I spoke at a synagogue yesterday on this topic on internet privacy and security. So I couldn't put this example. And this is the best example of the Internet of Things run amok. There is a Wi-Fi enabled rectal thermometer.
Okay. All right.
Now I want you
keeping
to,
an open
I'm
mind.
I'm not going to elaborate on this because I'm a smartass. But I've got
is that
to
part
say,
of the joke or
no?
Okay.
Oh, actually, very good. I didn't even get that. Okay, very good. But I've got to say, you know, use a little imagination about somebody hacking your rectal thermometer.
Yeah, I mean,
talk about making somebody your bitch, really.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's something to think
about. By the
way,
it's a real thing. It's a real thing. You know, I come up with this crazy stuff because it's crazy to me. It entertains me. And I know that every other normal person, not to say I'm necessarily normal, but every other normal person is going to go, geez, a tweeting diaper, a Wi-Fi enabled rectal thermometer? What the heck?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Go ahead.
We I think a couple of months back on the show mentioned there was an Internet of Things pregnancy test that was going around that would work
an
app on your smartphone. But it's another one of these things where you really have to ask, you know, what's the benefit of having this, you know, connected to the Internet of Things, which isn't actually a thing. The Internet of Things is basically other people's computers in your house.
That's absolutely right.
But for people who like maybe just tuned in, because we talked a little bit about your work during the first hour, but for people who just tuned in for the second hour, could you quickly describe like the work you do and what leads you to this field of expertise?
Okay, sure. Welcome to Steve Rombaum's College of Criminal Knowledge. I am an investigator. I've been an investigator. I'm starting my 30th year in New York. I mean, it's mind-boggling how much time has passed. I've been hanging around with you guys for 22 years.
It's amazing.
I mean, there are people who have been born to the First Hope Conference attendees and now have children themselves. There are grandchildren of the people who heard my first Hope Talk.
Well, let's not depress each other too much.
It doesn't depress me. I'm feeling great. I got a little head cold and some other maladies, but other than that, I'm feeling good.
Okay.
You know, time has flown, but I've been an investigator for more than 30 years. I've got a lot of experience overseas. I still do about 50% of my work overseas. I've done a lot of interesting investigations in the public interest. You know about one of them, the Nazi war crime stuff that I did.
Yes.
And I mentioned that because tomorrow is Yom HaShoah. It's Holocaust Remembrance Day. And I never liked the idea of Holocaust Remembrance Day. I think you should be remembering it a lot more than once a year. And I did. And I went out and I hunted down Nazi war criminals, found 170 of them. Interviewed a bunch of them undercover, because at that time I was busy being an undercover agent. So I took the ID that I was using working with the feds and went and found a few Nazis.
And where did you find them?
Mostly in Canada.
Canada.
Mostly in Canada. You know, when I started doing war crimes investigation, I believed the same misinformation that everyone else does, that the Nazis are hiding, they got plastic surgery, they have little villages in Brazil where everybody does Sig Heil every morning, and that basically they're desperately trying to hide from the Mossad and Simon Wiesenthal, who's hunting them down. And here's the truth. First of all, none of them are trying to hide. They have nothing to fear. Nobody hunted them. The Mossad stopped looking for them decades ago. The Simon Wiesenthal Center is not a Nazi hunting organization, never was a Nazi hunting organization. If you go to Rabbi Marvin Heyer, their director, he'll say, you know, Simon Wiesenthal was a Nazi hunter, but no, we don't hunt Nazis. We're an educational foundation. Nobody was hunting Nazis. Nobody. And they were living quite openly in the U.S., in Canada, in Britain, and in Australia. Most of them were smart enough to come to the West, because the ones that stayed in the part of Europe that fell behind the Iron Curtain, which is where most of these atrocities occurred during the Holocaust, KGB came, not a whole lot of access to the justice system. All of these people were thrown in graves with their victims. The one good thing the Soviet Union ever did was how they handled Nazi war criminals.
I'm surprised to hear that there wasn't a hunt for them in this part of the world, though.
I was surprised also, and I have to tell you, as a Jewish person, I think it's a black mark on the honor of the Jewish community that these people were able to move into major urban areas, very often living cheek to cheek with the Jewish community. I mean, New York, Massachusetts, the Northeast. In Canada, they centered in Montreal and in Toronto, which is where the major Jewish communities are in Toronto. I found a Nazi war criminal once. I went to the house and I said, we must be in the wrong place, because there was a mezuzah, the item that Jews put on their doors, on the door of this Nazi's house. And what I learned was downstairs was the landlord, who was a religious Jewish guy, and upstairs was the war criminal. And the downstairs landlord never knew.
Until you came along. And
well, it was an interesting conversation.
Well, yeah, I'm curious about that. How's the conversation go? You say, hey, you're a Nazi war criminal. Did they say, so what? It's
no,
not a big deal.
I was undercover. I took the name Salvatore Romano. I couldn't go, I'm Steve Rambam, Jewish guy from
Same
Brooklyn.
Initials, though.
Well, and that's because I had monogram shirts and I was too cheap. That's really true. No, that's really true. And I would knock on their door and I would tell them I was a professor at St. Paul's University of the Americas, which was a dummy university was set up down in Belize. Belize is basically fraudster central. You can go down there and set up anonymous bank accounts and anonymous corporations. All the people who are being outed in the Panama Papers were amateurs. They should have gone to Belize.
But you can't be anonymous anymore.
You can in Belize.
Okay, see, I got this out of you.
Well, your money can be anonymous. Uh-huh. Your money can be anonymous. But let's be clear. Let's be clear. We're also now in the Snowden era. So everybody is dumping data. This wasn't hacking, this Panama Papers from the law firm. This was somebody who was outraged, who had access to the data and sent it to a couple of newspapers. And then, of course, the people were screwed, and now there's a big hullabaloo. Now, I have to tell you, most of the things that are revealed in these great exposés, you have to look at it and say, did anybody not already know this? Did people not know that leaders of foreign countries hide their money and screw their citizens?
Yeah, that was my reaction,
this
too.
This is a revelation?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, okay, so you told us something about your early days. I'm very curious, though, about how you got started in the private eye world in the first place, and also what it was like then compared to now as far as what tools you had available
to you. That's a terrific question.
Especially any changes in the last year with all this leaking and encryption run-ups, if it's affected anything at all.
First of all, I have access to most of this stuff anyway. If I want to... if I want to get information out of Belize or out of Panama, I just go, I fly there, I poke around, I get a contact. I'm a field guy. I know that today my image is a tech weenie because I speak at IT security events and I lecture on open source intelligence, and now I teach federal government investigators on at undercover school, how to keep guys like me from outing them. You know, it's very, very hard today to be an undercover agent with facial recognition and being able to check back 20 years in somebody's life. Somebody comes to you and says, you know, I'm Frankie Lasagna. I'm a mob guy from Miami. Google will tell you if it's true or not. Very, very tough to be an undercover guy. I take a picture of you, Emmanuel. I put it into Google Image Search or TinEye or something we have in our office. I can identify you just from your photo. Your photo can give me your name, your address, your phone, your date of birth, your social security number, what books you read, what movies you listen to, all of that. I'm lucky. When I started in an analog world. When you needed to trace a phone number for a case, you had to either have a guy at the phone company, which I did. There was a number in Albany that you could call. You would give a code number, and it would give you the CNA.
Oh, the CNA number. Yeah. 518-471. Okay.
Correct. 474-something. Yeah. I forget what it was.
It ended in 3 ones, I think.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't even remember. But you know, back then, you either had to have the CNA number, or you had to do, if it wasn't in the local New York telephone company area, you had to go what – and if you go to the New York Public Library, you're going to see grooves in the steps as you walk up between the lines. I want to tell you, those grooves in the steps are an endless line of private investigators walking into the library and accessing the
Kohl's
and the Haynes and the Polk directories.
I remember spending time in libraries going through the Kohl's directories.
Well, I started out everything analog. I learned cameras shooting film. I learned data looking in libraries. I learned interviewing by interviewing. Today, you know, you've got three groups of private investigators and law enforcement investigators today. You've got the old guys, the old hairbags, who are incredible in the street. They can find anybody. They could sell ice to an Eskimo. They are wonderful face to face. But when it comes to computers, they type with their thumbs. They don't know what to do. Then you've got the new guys who are database cowboys. If they can't find it through Google Foo or through NCIC or a database, if they can't send a drone out to surveil you, they're screwed. The guys who are the best, in my opinion, are people from my era who know how to go out into the field and be real gumshoes. And at the same time, they know all the force multiplier methods, how to background a witness. You know, I was talking about this today. When I go to interview an important witness, I spend 20 minutes in front of the screen before I go and see them. And I learn everything I can about them. I learn their character. I learn what they care about. I learn their habits, their hobbies. Are they out of work? Are they an Obama supporter? Are they a Trump supporter? You know, how do they feel about this religion, that race? And by the time I get to their door, I've got my approach crafted that they're going to talk to me. And it really greatly increases my ability to get what I want.
You've been really good over the years predicting things that will be happening in a few years. When you had your beginning, did you think it would be like this now? Or anything remotely like this?
Oh, yeah. Look, I mean, if you look at the video of some of my old Hope Talks, you'll see I predicted Google Glasses 12 years ago. You'll see I talked about tracking license plates 15 years ago. I was talking about cell phone pinging when people didn't even understand, when there were analog cell phones, before there were digital cell phones. Nobody at that time, when I started talking about it, there wasn't even GPSA on phones. Skyhook was a big revelation. If you remember, the first iPhone was using Skyhook, and if you went across the Brooklyn Bridge, it showed your position in the water because of the Wi-Fi nodes.
Right.
You know, I've been pretty darn accurate about predicting. I want to tell you that there is going to be machine-man melding. People are going to get smart contact lenses, smart glasses. People are going to be able to get various attachments that they can wear or stick in their ear that are going to allow people to basically get massive amounts of information on the fly. The problem is going to be for the average small guy. The problem is going to be for somebody who really thinks that they're getting a legitimate news feed through Google or through Facebook. people are going to be molded into what Zuckerberg thinks the ideal human being should be. And I've got to tell you, there is absolutely zero difference between Facebook telling you what to think and Hitler telling you what to think.
Well, okay. I mean, that might be a bit of an extreme comparison.
No, it's not.
But
it's not.
I agree in one. Even if you 100% agree with Zuckerberg on something, you're not going to agree with him on something else, and he's still going to have that power. That's, I think, what the point is here.
The thing that made America great was individual rights and individual independence. You know, I really am one of these people who believe in American exceptionalism, that there are special and unique things about America. In America, unlike Europe and the rest of the world, if I want to defend myself, I have the right to a firearm. I don't have to crawl to the government for my safety. If I want to know who donated to my congressman, and is my congressman, you know, under the control of some entity that I hugely disagree with, I can go and look it up. If I want to know what happened with a police interaction on the corner of Atlantic and Bond, presumably the truth is going to be in the local newspaper. But if all of that stuff is filtered and it doesn't get to me raw,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't get to me untouched and uncurated, there's a problem. And that's privacy invasion 3.0. 1.0 was just plain old privacy invasion, gathering up data about people, you know, amalgamating it so that I could press a button and have the entire life story of Emmanuel Goldstein. That was privacy invasion number one, and I ranted about that for a while. Actually, I don't think ranted is the right word. I spoke coherently about it for a number of years. Nobody seemed to care. For the past couple of years and at the past hope, I spoke about anonymity. Anonymity is a big deal. You have a right to have your life unknown. You have a right to have an anonymous political opinion. You have a right to not have cyberbullies knowing who you are and where you are, and cyber stalkers. You have a right to live your life without constant scrutiny. Anonymity is now gone. The next thing right now is the right to raw information. That's the big issue now, and this is the biggest issue.
Amazing. We're talking with Steve Rambam, private law extraordinaire, who has been giving talks at Hope Conferences since Hope Conferences began, and some of the things you say are really eye-opening as far as what we have to look forward to. And it just opens up a whole world of questions. Bernie, I haven't given you the opportunity to ask anything.
Well, I was going to ask Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Bernie. Hey, sorry I couldn't get you on the phone. I'm going to call you later.
That's okay. Good, good. You're going to be speaking at the 11th Hope this July, either 22nd, 23rd, or 24th. And
God and the FBI willing.
Well, we know they're going to be there also, as they always are. Can you just sort of give us a preview?
Well, let me say they're definitely going to be at Hope. They're definitely going to be at Hope because I'm going to be in large part inviting them. We are going to have, you know, I'm educational chairman now of the Fraternal Order of Investigators, and we're doing something that's long overdue. I think that investigators, hackers, and journalists are all first cousins. We are all after the same thing, raw, unvarnished, free information. And I've reached out to the investigative community, and I got to tell you, there is an enormous amount of positive feedback about a law enforcement and a private investigative and an intelligence contingent coming and supporting the Hope Conference. And I've got to believe we're going to have anywhere between 100 to 200 representatives of the professional investigative community at Hope for the first time.
Now, that's something I just want to say to people. That's not something to be scared of. That's something that you can benefit from. You can learn from the knowledge that these people have and share your knowledge as well. Because, you know, we don't agree on everything. In fact, we probably fill a broadcast day with the things you and I don't agree on.
Right.
But that's no reason to stop listening and stop learning. And the things that you bring to the community are invaluable. It's almost indescribable. I'm wondering what your impression is overall of the hacker community.
Look, you know, to be blunt, I love you guys. I really do. I'm a very right-wing guy. That's certainly no secret. My political views are completely different from about 75% of the people that come to Hope. I mean, I'm not supporting this moron who's going to be the Republican candidate. I, by the way, I just have to put this out there. Who the hell wants a New York landlord as president?
That's a very good point.
You know, speaking as a guy who rents an apartment in Brooklyn, trust me, I don't want a landlord as president. But let's move away from that because that's a whole show.
No one's ever said that. That's important. Look, think of your landlord. Do you want them to be president?
Right. You know, do you want your landlord to have nuclear weapons at their control?
Okay, now it's just being scary.
Okay. So, look, I mean, I'm a big fan of the hacker community because the truth is, you guys support the important stuff. Freedom of action, freedom of information, individual independence. Whether you know it or not, you are much, much closer to my point of view regarding small government, regarding individual independence, regarding freedom of information than most people. I mean, there's a lot in common. There's a lot, and I'll tell you something, you're the most welcoming guys around. I mean, I've never hid my political attitudes, never hid who I am. And I got to tell you, the hacker community has been, you know, as a group and individually, great friends to me for 22 years. I can tell you that I've solved some horrendous cases working with members of the hacker community. Bernie and I even worked on something together in Philly, a runaway girl. He gave me a bunch of advice. We tracked her through Wi-Fi nodes to Philly, and we were able to rescue her. You know, I feel very much at home in the hacker community. I don't agree with you at all about, for example, things like Snowden, but on the other hand, I can sit here and give you good reasons why I don't agree with you about Snowden. It's not a knee-jerk thing.
I think that's something that people need to look at as far as not just in situations like this, but in their daily lives. The people that you don't agree with, you might have a great deal to learn from them and to share with them. And it's important to keep that dialogue open. I too often, and I see this in our community as well, we just shut down when it's somebody we don't agree with.
You can't be a troll.
Right. It's important to keep an open mind. I think in the hacker community, that's what appeals to you is the fact that we do listen.
Oh, very, very much. And I'll tell you something. My IQ goes up about 20 points when I leave a Hope because the people there are just all whiplash smart. And they're inquisitive and they want to learn about things.
Yeah, and that's something I think is very basic in what would be called maybe the hacker outlook on things is to take something like the community where there are people who are maybe like a political 180 from you or who are just like from somewhere else who are maybe of a different lifestyle or whatever, just all these differences we have between us. But there is such an eclectic crowd there, and it's very hackerish, I think, to mingle in a crowd like that and realize there are all these really interesting people that you can learn stuff you don't know yet from.
That's right.
Some of my dearest friends in the hacker community, you know, going back decades now, are people who politically disagree with me on many things. But we know that the real power is in sharing what we do have in common and what we are mutually interested in and learning new things that maybe we wouldn't have known about otherwise.
One thing I'd really like to get your perspective on, Steve, is an issue that we've heard a lot about over the last few months, even years. The government authorities complaining that with encryption, their job becomes impossible. Has encryption affected your job?
Oh, it's such a bunch of crap. Look, you need a whole show for this, but I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. First of all, and I'm going to preface this by saying again, I am a rah-rah, right-wing, pro-law enforcement guy. I think that law enforcement should have the right to get into a pedophile's cell phone or a pedophile's laptop or determine if there's information that will prevent the next terrorist bombing. I absolutely support that. But let me be honest. The FBI, in the most bumbling way possible, searched around for the most repulsive target to use to set legal precedent. Here you have two people who killed a bunch of innocent people, committed a terrorist attack, mass casualty terrorist attack in the homeland, killed themselves, and here's some digital devices. here's some digital devices that maybe will show who their command and control was or other acts being planned. Who could object to that? Well, me. Because what Apple was trying to, what FBI was trying to do was in the sleaziest, most dishonest way possible, not get a key to that phone, not get into that phone. They didn't go to Apple, unlock this particular phone for us. They tried to get an order for Apple to create a piece of software, a patch, a government OS, a GOVOS, that would allow opening every phone, every iPhone. Now, by the way, they really shot themselves in the foot because Apple, in their really persnickety way, is now developing an updated OS with a secure enclave that Apple won't be able to do that in the future. So the FBI has basically screwed the world and forced Apple and other companies to create operating systems that even they themselves can't get into. But let me just tell you a couple of things as a professional investigator who works all over the world and trips over these situations all the time. First of all, the big terrorist attacks, nobody was using encryption. They would go into a store and they would buy 20 burner phones. And each guy would have three phones on him. They'd have a conversation. They'd each throw away that phone. Next time, they'd move to phone number two. Next time, they'd move to phone number three. No encryption. $20 7-Eleven phones. And you know what? That's almost unbreakable. These are the digital equivalent of one-time pads, if you know what they are. So first of all, in Belgium, in Paris, the big attacks, 7-7 in London, zero encryption. Absolutely zero encryption. Second of all, the problem with the San Bernardino cell phone arose because some idiot at the instructions of the FBI bricked that phone and created a situation where they couldn't get into the iCloud backup. So they had to go to DEFCON 1. You know, there's just so much I could say about this, but in a nutshell, terrorists are not effectively using encryption. They are bumbling criminals like everybody else is a bumbling criminal.
I've often noticed that, but
and on top of that, it was enormous overreach. If you are a criminal and you have evidence in your house, I should be able to get a warrant that allows me to get the key to your house. That warrant should not give me a master key to everybody's house. Every innocent person, Every person who wants privacy, every person who wants to be left alone from the government. And let me put a disclaimer out there before I finish on this topic. I don't want people to think that because I've had a little kerfluffle with the FBI, I'm anti-FBI. On the contrary, that whole incident has made me even more pro-law enforcement because what happened? A couple of FBI agents overreached, people who were at the 2006 Hope, saw a bunch of FBI agents storm in and raid jackets and take me out of there. I was locked up for the weekend. No big deal. I got 40 hours of sleep. Came out, and what happened? The federal magistrate tore them to shreds. The two prosecutors who authorized it, they moved to the private sector almost immediately. Of the five agents, four of them are gone, and the fifth one, he's on the scuba team, or as my lawyer says, he swims with the fishes.
Wow.
You know, the government did not prevail. They got squashed. Individual rights of a defense investigator survived. I'm very proud of our justice system. But I have to tell you, I am an object lesson that the FBI has extraordinary powers, and they use them often just because they feel like it. And people who behave like that should not have access to everybody's cell phone.
Well, just to stick with the encryption issue for a moment, it's the government's contention that, okay, maybe they're not using encryption now, but they will someday. And what do we do when everything is encrypted and we can't unlock it at all? What's your answer to that?
All right. I've spent time over at the NSA, and I'm researching a book on the guy who, by the way, was a Snowden in his own right and is responsible for the forming of the NSA, essentially, indirectly. I've got to tell you, I find it pretty difficult to believe that it's not like the old Mad Magazine spy versus spy. I find it very hard to believe that the U.S. government is not one step ahead of encryption and other personal privacy methodologies. Now, I'll tell you something else. You can encrypt everything you want. It's not going to remove metadata, which for investigators is almost more important. If you're a target of investigation, if I know who you're talking to and for how long and where your phone was and what you were doing and how you were doing it and with who, I don't really care what you guys were talking about. I'll go grab person B and person C. Trust me, they'll tell me. I don't really care if I overheard the conversation. And by the way, encryption of cell phones only interferes with monitoring in the present. 99% of the time, by the time one of these homicide bombers blows themselves up, it's too late. You find out who the hell this guy was after the fact. There's no conversations for you to listen to. You can still go into their iCloud backup. And by the way, I don't know why iCloud is not a bigger part of this argument. You know, people are complaining about the FBI. The FBI has access to my phone. The FBI can get into my phone. Meanwhile, willy-nilly, you're giving every detail of your life and your contacts and your activities and everything that that little snitch cell phone knows that you're doing. You're giving it to the knuckleheads at Apple so they can sell you T-shirts with pictures of cats on them.
Well, that's the thing. People seem to willingly give away their privacy these days.
This is what I tell all the feds and all the PIs that I train. Self-contributed information is the best information, and it's most of the information. If you handed me a lamp and I rubbed it and a genie popped out, and that genie said, Steve, you have one wish, but here's your choice. You can have all the information that the government has on everybody. NSA, FBI, CIA, NYPD. NYPD is a real competitor for CIA at this point. Everything that governmental agencies and law enforcement agencies have on everybody, or you can have everything that private industry has. The credit bureaus, Facebook, Google, Apple, the marketing companies that nobody even talks about, Axiom, InfoUSA, who have a window into your soul. They know everything you do and everything you care about. If I have a choice between private industry or governmental and law enforcement, private industry, no question. Unless you're an Al-Qaeda member or a member of the Gambino crime family and the government is really watching you, private industry has exponentially more info about everybody.
A lot of our listeners and readers use Gmail. What would you say to them? Is Gmail safe?
Well, you know, there's a reason why Google says don't delete your messages, archive them. It's because, you know, just the keywords that can be pulled out of your email are an indicator of who you are and what you care about. I will give your listeners a tricky experiment. Two Gmail users should get together and start communicating, having a fake conversation about grandma who's come down with cancer. Have that conversation for about a week, and you will see that in the ads that they serve you, when you access Gmail through a browser, you're going to start seeing cancer books and cancer solutions and hospitals and things like that. You know, when you are using somebody else's computer system and you are agreeing to their terms of service, you're giving them access to the most intimate facets of your life. You know, your email communication over a period of a year will tell me everything there is to know about you, everything. What's important to you? Who are your closest friends? Who are your family members? Problems in your life, you know, what you're interested in. And you're giving Gmail access to that.
Yeah, there's an old chestnut that about like free services like Gmail, that if you're not paying for something, you're not the customer. You're the product being sold to the customers.
That's right.
And you even mentioned earlier, like you're having fun with an app. You know it's giving up a certain amount of your data, but you're having fun with the thing, so it's worth it. And it seems like with everything we do now, when we pick up one of these devices that's basically at the crossroads of every interaction we have with so many aspects of modern life, we're making a constant stream of decisions, like how much of me is this worth? How much of me is that worth? What's worth giving up so I can have this this toy or this tool or this whatever?
But sometimes it's ridiculous. Are you familiar with the flashlight app?
The flashlight app, yeah.
Okay. I used that the other day.
Okay. Have you looked at what the flashlight app?
It needs access to my contacts. It needs access to my GPS. That seems reasonable.
All the flashlight app does is it makes your screen glow. In return, you give up access to your address book. You give up access to your location. You give up access to your camera and your microphone. Why? It's outrageous. 45% of all apps, that's the conservative estimate, grab personal and private data. It's true. When you're getting something for free, you are the product. You're what's being sold.
And you know, a lot of people who work for these companies say, I can't understand why people complain about things that are free. And I think you've given a very good explanation as to why.
Because they don't know. Nobody reads terms of service. Look, I'll tell you one thing, and then I'll yield the floor. There's a famous experiment that was done at a college in England. A guy set up a booth on the quad, and he said, I will give you a candy bar for your password. You remember this? Mm-hmm. I will give you a candy bar for your password. And something like 40% of the people gave up their email password for a candy bar.
But they probably changed it right afterwards.
Who knows?
Wow. There was somebody who did something similar, I think it was in Brooklyn, where they had cookies, as in the food, and they were shaped like the icon of Facebook or Twitter or what have you. And in order to get a free cookie, you had to give up not necessarily your password, but some people were asked for their birth date, some people were asked for their mother's maiden name, and you know, social, and the same sort of idea.
I just wanted to remind everybody that we're fundraising tonight. The pledge line is 516-620-3602. We're almost out of time, so please give a call to the station.
If you've benefited from this conversation in any way, if you find yourself riveted to the radio, if you're sitting in your car by the garage and you don't want to go inside because you don't want to miss a second of it, consider giving a call to that phone number, because this radio station makes these conversations possible. 516-620-3602. Please call.
You know what? I've been having so much fun, I forgot why I came on the show.
Yes.
Which was to talk about the privacy victim.
Yes.
I came on the show to do two things. Number one, to help you with your fundraising, which we'll talk about in a second. But the other, you know, turn up your radio, folks. Stop microwaving soup or whatever you're doing. Come over to the radio and please listen to this. And if you're listening to the podcast, it may not be too late. My telephone number is 212-969-0286. That's 212-969-0286. Or if you're listening now, call into the show. What's that number again?
Right now, to call the 718-780-8888-48.
Okay.
That's to call the on-air. You want to talk to people on air.
I want a privacy victim. I want somebody. Here's the criteria. I want somebody who's old enough and active enough, not somebody who's 14 and has been hanging out in the basement their whole life, but I want somebody who's had a life and has had a reasonably interesting life, ideally somebody with a few things to hide, who will let me use them as a privacy victim, who will let me investigate them, who will cooperate with my investigation, and who will let me put up on the screen at the next hope all of the stuff that's available about them through open source and through moderately proprietary stuff, not governmental databases. The point is to show what's out there on everybody. And then on top of that, we will look at their Facebook, we will look at their Google activity, and we will show how their general consciousness is now being shaped by these large companies. I need a privacy victim. Trust me, you will have a lot of fun. I'll be gentle, no rubber glove. You know, this is not a proctology exam. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it's a digital proctology exam.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, you very well may be getting people to behave in different ways, since this is basically the next level with all of this information and a correlation going on. We maybe will get someone to say something in particular or do something.
Now, Steve, you want people to call in now, but they're not going to give out their information now.
No,
right?
But if anybody has a question, if anybody wants a clarification, call in now. If anybody has a question about anything that we've discussed or any investigative topic, call in now, or feel free to call me after the show. Not tonight, because I'm going home and going to sleep, but tomorrow, 212-969-0286, or pull up my company my company webpage and send something to the office. My company is Pollorium, P as in Peter, A-L-L-O-R-I-U-M.
And the phone number to call now if you want to ask Steve a question, 718-780-8888. More importantly, though, if you want to pledge to the station and keep us on the air, 516-620-3602. You know, I think this conversation is worth $1,000. What do you think? If you have it, well, please call that number and donate it, and you're assured of more conversations like that in the future.
Okay, I'll say this. I'm not allowed to offer any benefit, or I have to be very careful what I say here. Everybody's suddenly tensing up and getting nervous, wondering what I'm going to say.
The armed guards are a bit
much. I see Emmanuel's got his finger on the slider to suddenly silence me if I say something wrong, one of the seven bad words or whatever. But let me say that if you give a large donation and help support this show, it is entirely possible that I will be inclined to do something beneficial for you if you call me at a later date.
There you go.
Did I say that in a careful
way?
No,
yeah, I think that was perfect. That was well done.
Really good.
Listen, I'm from Brooklyn, and I'm an investigator. I'm good at sneaking.
Let's take a phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Oh, excellent. Radio, this device is filtered. I wanted to start off by saying thanks for the show so far. Been trying to get information through FOIA requests, but typically that seems like a dead end or somebody puts some ancillary subcharge on it, kind of like dealing with a bank.
Okay. I will tell you, don't lose hope. I have had enormous success with FOIA requests that I filed. You may have to go to a professional. There are crowdsourced FOIA requesters, like, what is it, Muckrock? Muckrock is a good example. There are people on the internet. You can email them or fill out a form with your FOIA request. If they feel that it is genuinely something in the private interest, they will, for free, beat up on the governmental agency for you.
We have these people show up at Hope, too. So
okay.
You can do it
well,
there.
And this is a good reason for you to come to Hope, support Hope, meet these people, nudge them through the whole conference until they agree to take your FOIA request. No. There are people that you can upload a description of your FOIA request. And if they feel that it's something that's genuinely in the public interest, they'll do it for you. They'll process it professionally. They'll harass the governmental agency. The only thing is they will share your information with the world, which, if you're listening to the show, you probably don't mind.
Okay, we have another caller joining us. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hello, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, this is the interviewer that you have on. Can you give slowly his phone number again, 212?
I apologize. I speak like a Brooklyn guy. I speak too fast.
Everyone on the radio station does the same thing.
Yeah, we all do that.
It's 212-969-0286. Again, that's 212-969-0286.
All right, and that should suffice. Did you have any other question?
Yes. My question is this. There's been a great deal of reports from authenticated sources that the FBI has been operating the Jade Helm experience. Now, you know anything about the Jade Helm experience?
I have a home and an office in Texas where Jade Helm took place. And these are the same people who told you that a black helicopter is following you home. It's a bunch of crap. Don't worry about Jade Helm. Nobody is setting up civilian concentration camps for dissenters. Now, we'll see what Trump does. With him, it may be possible.
Have you watched Colony? I mean, this stuff's really kind of believable.
Well,
all right, thanks for that call. We're going to try and take one more. Good evening. You are on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Good night. How you doing? I have a question. I was wondering, the fact that they
go ahead.
I wanted to say your guest tonight. I mean, tonight's show is a pleasure, and this is an excellent show.
Thank you.
I called last week, and I said I was sending out 40 because I knew the pledge was coming up. I'm sending another one too because I mean,
all
I
right.
really need this.
Awesome.
I really, really need this.
Thank you so
and
much.
I don't even want anything for it. I just put it a money order in an envelope. It sent it straight over to WBAI.
And make sure you mention Off the Hook. That way we get credit.
Papa all needs right. a new keyboard, baby.
Well, thanks.
I got a question.
Thanks so
much.
Go ahead. What's your question?
You know, it was so informative listening to you tell it from the other side. When the fact that they're trying to, like most places nowadays, if you try to apply for a job even, it's very rare that you can actually even go like you used to back in the day and actually fill out a paper application, you know, hand it in to somebody. So most places now want an application online before they even see you face to face.
That's right.
All that information, is that protected in any way from
yes.
from
yes.
the
yes.
access
yes.
to
yes.
the sources
yes.
you're talking about?
Yeah, let me tell you, there are federal laws. This is actually one good thing that the feds do.
Okay.
There's the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act, and there's the Federal Fair Employment Act. Not only is your information protected, but you are entitled, if you're denied a job, you are entitled to a copy of the report that caused your job to be denied, and you are legally allowed to challenge it.
Okay. Thanks, everybody who called in. And again, if you want to write to us, oth@2600.com. Steve, we hope we find a victim for you because we have
I need a victim, and I hope everybody comes to hope. And if you are a law enforcement officer or an investigator, we are going to have an entire investigative track, either at the facility or next door in the New Yorker. We're going to have a lot of fun this year.
All right. Steve Rambam, Private Eye, thanks so much for joining us. Look forward to your talk at the 11th Hope. More info on Hope at hope.net. And we will see you, I think, in 2 weeks. There are 2600 meetings this week, Rob?
Yes, indeed. Friday evening, all over the world, 2600.com/meetings to find one near you or start one near you.
All right. For Off the Hooks, Emmanuel, have a good night. See you soon. Good night.
Laboratory Dexter. Finally, I am rid of my sister forever, and I can enjoy conducting my experiments in peace.
Yes, Dexter. All systems are operating at optimum efficiency.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, and we are asking you to go to the phone, to become a member of independent media. please support what you listen to and watch. We're not brought to you by the weapons manufacturers or the insurance companies. We're not brought to you by big pharma, oil, gas, coal. We're brought to you by viewers and listeners like you. And to follow up on our discussion today about the war on whistleblowers and on the press, we bring you a film by Robert Greenwald called The War on Whistleblowers. The first story told in this film is about a Marines whistleblower named Franz Geil. You'll also hear the voices of New York Times reporter David Carr, reporter Seymour Hersh, and Dana Priest of The Washington Post, Daniel Ellsberg, advocates from the Project on Government Oversight, and many others.
Galileo and Copernicus got the whistleblower treatment for challenging the conventional wisdom that the world was flat and that the universe circles around us. And Galileo spent the rest of his life under house arrest. They were the pioneers of modern science. Whistleblowers are the pioneers of change.
Daniel Ellsberg is the source of the Pentagon document.
It is time to quit making national heroes out of those who steal secrets and publish them in the newspaper.
I began copying the Pentagon Papers. Give them to the American Congress and share them with the American public.
I came to realize that a wrongful war was going on and would continue to go on unless these lies were exposed.
He is the preeminent whistleblower in the deepest sense.
Whistleblowers have become a kind of fundamental part of how our democracy works.
Mark Felt, the former associate director of the FBI, revealed that he was the man that helped bring down the Nixon administration.
They have unquestionable patriotism and a lot of courage.
His testimony was a key to the eventual $246 billion settlement of five tobacco companies.
Jeffrey Wigand brought down Big Tobacco.
Former Enron employee Sharon Watkins, better known as the Enron.
Ex-cop Frank Serpico changed the NYPD forever when he revealed a multi-million dollar payoff corruption scam.
You have to go up against the odds to do the right thing.
Karen Silkwood took on one of the biggest companies in America, crusading against America's nuclear power industry.
And in the face of fear, she continued to collect
it. Changed his what?
An American hero,
Jeff Wigand.
The greatest gift that the national security state ever got was obviously the ability to exploit the fear of 9/11 very aggressively without opposition to enjoy this massive booming growth in power.
Exerting that vast power, the national security state surrounds itself within a wall of silence where whistleblowers and the free press are attacked and vilified, even when lives are at stake.
The day that Major Megan McClung was killed by an IED while riding in a Humvee was the tipping point for me.
I had to do something. If not me, then who? And if not now, then when? It was one of those situations. And I just said, no. It doesn't matter what the consequences are, personal or otherwise. Right? I said, this needs to be fixed.
Whistleblowers are just people who said there's something more important here than my boss or the general or the admiral or the president.
The most common vehicle used was the Humvee. They were never built to withstand weapons that the insurgents were using, these IEDs.
The estimates are that about a third of the casualties in Iraq were due to Humvees.
Hundreds of Marines were tragically lost, probably thousands maimed unnecessarily. So I said, let's replace the Humvees with what are called MRAPs, mine-resistant ambush protective vehicles. The MRAP was bound to save lives. It's more survivable than the Humvee because it has this V-hull that deflects the blast out rather than focusing it or carrying it straight up. The base is much higher off the ground, so it's further away from the center of the blast. Tailor-made for bombs or IEDs. But it wasn't a new solution. The Marines had asked for MRAPs, but that request had been pushed back.
Pentagon, intentionally or unintentionally, had preventably caused 19 months in delays, and that had a direct impact on lost lives, unnecessarily. That came with these concerns to my supervisors. No success. Then communicating directly with the agency that's supposed to be providing the support. No luck there. Then working with Systems Command. Well, Systems Command depended on other parties. No luck there. And so I was determined to bring this to the attention of the Office of the Secretary of Defense. But when the officials saw the brief that I was going to present, they said, absolutely not. That cannot be allowed to go forward.
And when they get to the end of that chain of command and it becomes more important that nobody get embarrassed, that some people eventually decide, you know what, I'm going to do the outside play.
I contacted Sharon Weinberg of a blog called Danger Room.
He was a champion for fighting against the Pentagon bureaucracy that was slowing things down.
Military industrial. And the military piece is supposed to be in charge. Tell the industry, you know? But what happens is the bureaucracy has its own interests.
We had documents backing it up, and so we went ahead and published it.
Publishes the actual document on Danger Room, which was very, very helpful. That got the attention of Senator Biden and his staff. They asked whether I would like to speak to USA Today. I said yes. I got a call from Tom Vandenbroek, I believe, the very next day.
And as soon as I found out about Franz, I thought, oh my God, I've got a real live, honest to God whistleblower who knows what's going on.
I provided him unclassified information, which was key to understanding the issue.
I thought immediately we were embarking on a bigger project to find out why these vehicles hadn't been getting there in the first place.
And immediately he took and ran with it. He understood and was fortunately able to bring this to a front page article.
These have to be genuine, important issues that are being exposed. In Franz's case, when you hear about decisions that are made that save thousands of lives, there's nothing in front of that.
Now, a new Pentagon study. Are our troops getting what they need when they need it?
Is the U.S. military shortchanging its troops?
According to Franz Geil, the Marine bureaucracy has continued to under-equip our troops for years.
I contend that officials knowingly delayed or refused the provision of urgently requested capabilities like MRAP.
Geil says hundreds of troops have been killed.
Delays in military.
They're not going to tell you what to vote. The only way to find that out is from people on the inside.
So they couldn't allow something like this to happen again.
Fight them with the truth. That's what it's all about.
Now it's in the press, and now the Commandant's getting asked about it during Senate Armed Services Committee testimony.
Does the administration have a plan to replace each of those Humvees in Iraq with some variation of an MRAP?
We don't have an answer right now on how long term I think the MRAP is going to be.
2-3 days after, actually, my story and run on MRAPs, I was taken aside by a senior defense official who told me that my access was going to dry up for writing a story like that. It wasn't going to change the way I reported, but I thought it was interesting that, you know, someone at his level would take the time to make that threat.
They were using all these personnel actions against me. I'm the substandard employee, bottom 3%, unreliable, untrustworthy, et cetera, et cetera. After investigations and after all these personnel actions and reprisals, I was placed on administrative leave.
The MRAPs are starting to get media attention, but the guy who makes it happen, Franz Geil, is losing his security clearance and is getting pounded on in his own job.
I was fearful. If I have to leave the government now and I don't have security clearances, we're going to have to move away. I can't get a job around here. You can't do anything without security clearance around D.C. area. I knew that life was going to go shoom, fall off a cliff.
With the things that's going through in his head and work and family and my children, all this chaos thing, we went through with it. I mean, like, tough time, you know, but we hang in there, et cetera.
When Gates saw the stuff the whistleblower was pushing out there, everything changed.
Secretary of Defense Gates, first thing he did is establish what was called the MRAP Task Force.
Vehicles like the MRAP. provide the best protection available against roadside bombs, and so the need for these kinds of vehicles will not soon go away.
The MRAP started going out there en masse.
This is the largest acquisition program for the Department of Defense since World War II.
Working around the clock to keep these trucks in the fight.
We sent more than 24,000 MRAPs to our warfighters.
This MRAP saved the lives of five Marines who were in it.
Dust everywhere, and then when the dust settled, everybody was like, are we okay? Are we okay? And we were all good and moved on.
It protected our soldiers. That's what matters.
We were in a lot better shape than had we been in a Humvee.
Made a difference, saved lives every day.
We were all lucky to be alive.
The MRAP saved my life.
We were able to bring everybody home alive.
The number